Hello and welcome to The Short Squeeze, a podcast about what's happening in financial markets in the coming week. I'm Lucy Battersby, editor of Markets Live, a daily live blog on the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age websites. This week we're talking about the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, we're big fans, and we'll be talking about the Virgin Australia restructure, which is getting to the pointy end this week. We'll discuss why it might be time to look at smaller companies on the stock markets now that the big end of the market has rallied so far from the March bottom, and take a brief look at the just tiny topic of the US presidential election. Today I'm joined by IG Markets analyst Kyle Rodder. Good morning, Kyle.
Good morning, Lucy.
So we both discovered that we have a mutual admiration for the Reserve Bank of New Zealand.
Yes.
I'm a big fan of their kind of decisiveness and whatever it takes attitude, at least compared to the Reserve Bank of Australia. I mean, recently they cut rates by 50 basis points. They're doing the groundwork, warning everyone that there might be negative interest rates coming up soon, whereas the RBA seems so much more cautious, and after their monthly meetings, there's always an audience shouting out, like, do they get it? Don't they get it? Why aren't they cutting? Why aren't they doing more? But you've got a pretty good explanation of why the Reserve Bank of New Zealand seems to be a bit more kind of active.
Yeah, I have my theory, I suppose. I guess like the wonderful thing about the RBNZ is that it's a sophisticated enough central bank managing a sophisticated enough economy to be able to do some reasonably, I suppose, funky, unconventional things with its policy settings. But by the same token, they're quite small, and when it comes to moving financial markets beyond just say the Kiwi and maybe rates markets in New Zealand, is that their impact is quite minimal. So unlike, say, you know, obviously the Fed's the big one that, you know, if they say anything, it moves markets straight away. But, you know, the same goes for the BOE, the ECB, BOJ, RBA to a large extent as well, is that with the RBNZ, they can say things without worrying about having completely or very widespread unintended consequences like those other central banks. So like last month, when they met, you know, they came out and flagged that maybe they'll start looking at negative interest rates, maybe they'll look at other ways of intervening in currency markets, buying foreign assets, increasing their asset purchasing program, all of these different things that it's very unlikely that you'd see from another central bank. I mean, our RBA is a great example because they're just so conservative and been so conservative throughout this. But the RBNZ is always in a great position to be able to sort of be at the forefront of some of those funkier ideas as it relates to monetary policy at any given point in time. And as a result, they're a little bit of a barometer, I suppose. And I think this week that we've got the RBNZ, they're not supposed to do anything with their policy. But we're going to be looking pretty closely at their commentary because they have seemed to have been touching on themes that other central banks aren't willing to touch on publicly, but they'd probably be discussing privately quite a lot.
I'm also a big fan of their communication. I mean, from the Reserve Bank of Australia, we after a monetary policy meeting, we get that statement of about, you know, 10 paragraphs or so. The New Zealanders, they put out pages of infographics, and it's concise, it's not patronising, so that someone without a finance degree but who wants to understand what's happening in their economy can understand it. And they've made themselves accessible and comprehensible to the bulk of the population in a way that the Reserve Bank of Australia kind of misses the mark. Their explanations are much more geared towards kind of students who would be studying finance in year 7 or 8. And they even have a webinar where the public can ask questions of the bank's chief economist after their meetings, which I think is fantastic.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, if you look at the way the exit communication strategy plays out, it's much more comprehensible. There's a much greater breadth to what they actually provide in terms of information. And they do speak, like even if you look at the way that they communicate in their statements, you know, they're very careful about making sure that their language is very, very comprehensible and clear to the layperson. So I think they, again, they're probably in a position where they can experiment a little bit more because they have less pressure on them to not take risks, if you will. But yeah, I mean, with the RBNZ meeting this week and given how significant those meetings have been from a policy, abstract policy point of view, their input's going to be really, really fascinating. And again, it's likely to be watched pretty closely.
Yeah, okay, we'll keep an eye out for it. Thanks. as we speak, there are currently two parties and maybe a third that are making plans and hoping to be selected as the preferred buyers of Virgin Australia. The administrators Deloitte are going to be looking over the plans currently put together by two private equity firms, Bain Capital and Cyrus Capital Partners. But just over the weekend in the last few days, there has emerged a third party, and that's the bondholders. So there's $1.8 billion worth of Virgin bonds that are out there. That's just under a third of the total debt owed by the airline when it went into administration. And the bonds are held by a mixture of institutional investors and mum and dad investors, and they're one of the few corporate bonds that were listed on the ASX. Apparently there's about 6,000 of the bondholders, or maybe not. No one really knows. It's a bit of a mystery. And this morning, our reporter Patrick Hatch was talking about how the bondholders have actually been getting together and might be putting forward a proposal to buy out Virgin Australia. And so it's really interesting because you might get these mum and dad investors who actually end up as part owners. They thought they were holding on to some of the debt and they might actually end up part of the owners. Yeah, wow. Yeah, Kyle, have you been watching? Is this making a lot of waves in, I mean, they're kind of, the action is not on the stock market as much. It's with the administrators. But it's a really interesting story because the bondholders thought they might end up with only 10 cents in the dollar. And now they might be getting a bit more than that.
Yeah. I mean, for me, the big interesting thing with the Virgin Australia story is that it's sort of created a bit of a collision of all the different issues that are affecting financial markets and the corporate landscape with this coronavirus crisis, which is effectively when you have a business that is so systemically important to an industry and to an entire economy, who's left to I suppose, hold the can, if you will, when things go wrong? Who's there to bail out whom in situations where things do go wrong? And, you know, what is the most practical and efficient way of being able to manage a business that is obviously so systemically important, but at the same time is a private enterprise and has, you know, duties to its shareholders and obviously its bondholders too. So while I think from a financial market perspective, you know, as far as watching what our clients have done, they've probably lost a little bit of interest in trading Virgin shares compared to some of the other airlines. Some of the airlines have been some of the most popularly traded stocks for IG clients for quite some time, and those reasons are reasonably obvious. I think for particularly mum and dad investors and those who have an interest in the industry, this whole process is going to be fascinating because on the one hand, you do have those private interests that emerge with any corporation, especially when it comes to understanding the capital structure, versus obviously the interest that we all have in making sure that the business stays afloat, that it effectively can remain a competitive force in the airline industry and in the Australian economic landscape going forward. So for me, all of those sorts of issues coming about being fleshed out will be fascinating once I think Deloitte and its counterparts get to the bottom of this one, because I think it will be a little bit of a sign of the times as to how businesses have to operate within a world where there's much greater pressure on corporations to be socially responsible and accountable to their shareholders and other financial stakeholders.
Our cousins over at the Financial Review called the bondholders the kind of the Stephen Bradbury of this administration process. But yeah, if it does end up being refloated by the bondholders, that would give an opportunity for investors to invest into it. Whereas if it goes to Bain or Cyrus, it becomes privately owned. And then there's only really one airline to invest in Australia. So we'll see how that plays out. Thanks, Kyle.
IG is a world-leading online trading provider, giving traders access to over 16,000 global financial markets on our award-winning platforms. With over 45 years of experience, you can trade with confidence when with IG. Visit ig.com.au for more information. All trading involves risks. Issued by IG Markets Limited, AFSL 220440.
Welcome back. In this half of the podcast, we like to talk about areas that are just popping up on our radar. This week, I'd like to talk about small caps and mid-size caps, which for the sake of argument for this conversation, we're going to mean a company with a market cap under US $20 billion. And I realise that discounts nearly all but the top of the ASX 20. Anyway, the small and mid-cap companies, they haven't rallied anywhere near as hard as the biggest companies, particularly in the US. And I've been talking to a few fund managers who have just pointed out that the small and medium-sized companies, they haven't rebounded and they're at a much cheaper valuation than the larger companies. I was chatting to Ian Carmichael of Fairlight Asset Management, and he said the difference hasn't been this big for a decade. And he also pointed out that smaller caps, they can only get so cheap relative to the larger ones before investors start realizing what's happening, and they move their money out of the big caps and put it back into the small and the medium-sized caps. And Kyle, there's also been a lot of talk about companies that might be going into bankruptcy as the economy, you know, continues to struggle from the coronavirus shutdown. And Mr. Carmichael pointed out that if you're a listed company, you're probably in a much better position than if you're a privately owned company, because you can always tap your shareholders for a bit more capital. So these small and medium-sized companies, they're in not too bad a position. Their share prices haven't rallied so hard. They don't have to go into bankruptcy. They always still have that extra opportunity to raise a bit of money from their shareholders. So it's a space that's worth keeping an eye on.
It certainly is. And I mean, if you look at it from, like, say, a technical strategist point of view, and I like to look at this very closely, is that, say, in the United States, you look at the correlation and spread between the S&P 500 and the Russell 2000. And often when you try and find sort of, I guess, a little bit of validation for a real bullish mood in the market, is that you'll see that mid-cap and small caps, as expressed through the Russell 2000, start to either outperform or at least bridge the gap in performance with their larger cap counterparts, which is basically the S&P 500. The S&P 500 is more or less only large and mega-cap stocks. And what we have seen recently is that through May, when markets were getting really, really bullish, and there was this hope for a quicker rebound in the global economy than was previously expected, those small and medium cap stocks started to really catch up to their large and mega cap counterparts, as effectively market participants priced in a change to economic fundamentals, that you didn't have this sort of just yield and liquidity driven rally in financial markets that just went all into, you know, the high end of the market. Interestingly, throughout June, that trade sort of waned a little bit, which you might suggest is perhaps some sort of sign of concern that, you know, maybe the recovery isn't going to be as quick in the US economy. You know, small caps and medium caps tend to be much more sensitive to the business cycle and fundamentals of a domestic economy. So that's been fascinating over the last 2 or 3 weeks. But for me, you know, a real sign if there is a real pickup in market sentiment will come if that Russell 2000 starts to bridge the gap with the S&P 500 again. It'll say that there's actually a true bullishness about the fundamentals, you know, rather than, again, just a yield and liquidity-driven rally by a select small number of stocks that can be, like we've discussed in the past, reasonably divorced from Main Street fundamentals.
And in the past couple of weeks here on the ASX, we've had a lot of positive surprises, particularly amongst retailers, who just found that people were spending their money mostly online. And a lot of those retailers are in the All Ords. They're not in the ASX 200. And they have reinstated dividends. They've increased their forecasts, their full-year forecasts, or confirmed forecasts that had been cancelled. So we'll keep an eye on how all the small and the medium-sized companies are growing. And Kyle, what's on your radar? There's a small political event going on overseas that you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, no, I caught wind at some stage over the weekend that there's an election in the United States in November. Who would have thought? I had to see a half empty rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma to work that out. But no, I wanted to touch, I suppose, very quickly on US politics, just because it's been something that's obviously driven markets a lot over the last couple of weeks, and we haven't discussed in depth specifically just yet. But for me, and for what it's worth, when it comes to public polling, polls in the United States is starting to show a real pickup for Joe Biden and the Democrats more broadly to, one, take the presidency in November, as well as perhaps sweep through Congress in terms of congressional voting when that comes about as well. So, considering the myriad of issues in US politics at the moment, obviously we have civil rights concerns. We've got potentially, and this is a big issue over the weekend, potentially a second wave, a serious second wave of the coronavirus sweeping through the United States, as well as all the existing foreign policy issues and political issues that have been held up by sort of Trumpism over the last few years. We're getting to the point now, normally it happens maybe 2 months before the actual election, so we're talking August, where we're getting reasonably close to the point where market participants become very, very focused on the outcome of the US election. And normally that's reasonably bearish for stocks. So given the importance of this election, given the, you know, profound events that have occurred in the world in 2020, we're getting to that flashpoint now where market's going to be looking at the election, and an election that's going to be perhaps the most significant that we've seen in quite some time. So just watching this the tea leaves on that one and see how markets react as some of these issues are fleshed out.
Do we know if Donald Trump has particular financial policies that he wants to implement if he wins a second term? The first term, it was all about tax cuts, which he did get through, and they gave, you know, that was a pretty big boost, a bit of a one-off boost, but it was a pretty good boost for the companies.
Yeah, well, I mean, in the last couple of weeks, I think one thing that buoyed markets is the announcement from the Trump administration of roughly $1 trillion worth of infrastructure spending. And you could kind of argue that maybe Trump is trying to position himself here for his second term as an FDR type of president, where, you know, coming out of a crisis, a big spending on revamping infrastructure and roads. And there's been criticism for years that, you know, the United States and its aging infrastructure is decaying and ugly and needs to be spruced up a little bit. So in terms of formal economic policies, I did a little bit of looking around on Trump's website over the weekend, and a lot of it more talks about the goals that the administration feels as though it's already kicked in the last 3 or 4 years, and not much on future policy. But I think one thing that markets will be following quite closely is this, I suppose, inclination, it would seem, from the Trump administration to go big on infrastructure, knowing that could be popular and that he could, again, sort of hark on this kind of FDR sentiment as being the leader to push themselves out of a crisis. And even probably more broadly than that, is that because the genie is a bit out of the bottle now when it comes to fiscal spending, and it's almost a bit of a race to the bottom of which party can spend more, whether we will get this situation where markets will be kind of relishing this whole kind of competition between the Democrats and the Republicans to potentially outspend each other in the next four-year term. So I think that's from an economic point of view what's really going to be watched. Firstly, that infrastructure spending program potentially, but even on top of that, you know, the willingness from both parties to really spend big effectively to win over the electorate at this crucial election.
Okay. Thank you, Kyle. This has been The Short Squeeze, a podcast produced by The Age and Sydney Morning Herald in conjunction with IG Markets. You can follow daily stock market news on our live blog. And feel free to subscribe to this podcast via your podcast platform. You can catch us again next week.